Good evening, everyone. I'm giggling because it seems awfully formal to be standing up in front with microphones, but that's also, it's because we're recording tonight. So there's a lot of people throughout the world who can't be here, but are really interested in what's going on.
Thank you for reminding me.
Yes. So you have a huge invisible audience to contribute.
Not that I want to marginalize those at a distance. Hi, everyone.
But yeah, hi, everyone.
I'm kind of nervous.
And thank you all for coming. I'm Katya. Some of you I know well, and a few of you here are from the intensive. Thank you all for coming. And this is the Research Institute, which some of you might know. The Research Institute, yeah, it's kind of like an institute. It's a research symposium. And this is something we do a few times a year. And we invite people from the community, students, graduates, faculty to come and share their experiences with process work. So it's both formal and informal research. And in a way, I feel like process work is a kind of ongoing research project in that it keeps evolving. And what's really interesting to me and what I'm excited about tonight with you is then how does process work translate out into the world, into all the different work that we're doing, our personal lives. And so that's some of what Elva's going to share. We're going to learn about together tonight. So I'd like to introduce Elva Redwood, who is a process work diplomat and a recent graduate of the Master's in Process Work program and a writer. And she has a private practice locally here in Portland. And tonight, Elva's going to be talking about her experience working with the low-income public housing community. So thanks for sharing your work and experiences.
Thank you. Thanks, Katya. All right. Hey, come in. Grab a chair and let's get close. I'm thinking because there's so few of us here, we could just say our names around the room so that, I don't know about you guys, but it would help me feel more comfortable. So
let's go ahead and take the mic.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kamisha.
I'm Katya.
Kathy.
Kathy.
I'm Susan. Hello.
Hi, I'm Nicole.
Anthony.
Makiko.
Suzette.
All right. Thanks. So I don't really know how to do this, and I have notes, but I'm not very good at following notes, so I'm just going to plunge in, and if anybody has anything to, you know, you want to ask any questions, or if you have experiences you want to, like, share with the room as well, I'd welcome that. And I don't see myself as any kind of expert at all, either in process work or in working in resident services. It's just what I do. And so I'm just really here to, I think the main thing that motivates me is to share some of the world that I witness every day in my work, which is something that, I've worked in community mental health for several years, and before that, my experience was limited, I should say. So I just feel like strongly there's a lot of people in the world who don't know about the kind of environment, the kind of things that people with very low income work or live in. So that's my main motivation. And I hope to be able to somehow fathom how process work contributes to the way that I work there. Because it's actually turned out to be a lot different from what I thought it would be. So I got this job. It's complicated, but I got this job basically because my practice wasn't building up as fast as I wanted it to be, which is normal, I think, for most people. And so I kind of landed in this job, and I'd never heard of resident services before. I actually got it through the mental health agency that I was working with before. I was working as a counselor. And so I kind of landed in this job not knowing at all what it was. And I wonder if there's anybody in the room who actually knows what resident services is, because I'd never heard of it before. And it's actually, there have been resident services offered in low-income housing for at least 10 years in the States, and I don't know about other places. But so basically, I don't know where the idea came from, but mostly from like Housing Authority, which would be the same as like council-run housing in other places. They're trying to address like the high turnover of tenants or people getting evicted, and it's addressed. There's in the industry the people, the social work side of it, the people who support helping people to improve their lives are trying to sell it to the economically minded side of the industry, the property management and stuff, in that it will save them money. So the idea is that there's somebody available thing, where, I mean, in the building that I work in, there's 80 apartments. So there's 80 people who live there. There's somebody available there who can help people with anything. And it's not the same thing as having a case manager. Like, a lot of people get confused between those things. Like in mental health, in community mental health, people will have a case manager that's basically the social worker that is assigned to them that kind of helps manage their life. And that's not the role of the resident services coordinator. I'm there to, if somebody wants to go to college and they don't know the first thing about going to college, they can come into my room and we can get on the internet and look up the local community college and find out when their open day is and find out how they with the counselor there and stuff. But I'm not supposed to encourage people with my ideas. It's like they come. And there's some research being done to quantify how much money it saves property management. I don't think it's been very conclusive, but the overall opinion is that it does lower the eviction rate. So it costs property management a huge amount of money every time somebody's evicted. Because they have to... So... Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
So the question is how it exactly help save money?
Well, it depends why the person's evicted. The most common reason someone's evicted is because they don't pay their rent. Hi, come in. Sit down. That's. So if someone doesn't pay their rent, they'll get an eviction notice on the 10th of the month or so. But it'll take 2 or 3 months at least to evict them. So that's 2 or 3 months of rent, plus the court fees, plus any damages done to the apartment. Because someone who's being evicted is not going to be careful about their apartment. And plus any, like however long it takes to then rent the apartment again. So you're looking at 6 months rent probably every time someone's evicted for non-payment of rent. So if there's somebody in the building who is available for people to come to when they're in trouble, and there's actually in this, I don't know so much about, I've only ever worked in social services in this city, so I don't really know about other places, but in Portland, there's a lot of agencies that can help people say they can help them with 1 month's rent if there's an emergency. and there are a lot of places that can help pay your electricity bill and things like that. And it's always just in emergencies, but there are a lot of resources out there that a lot of people aren't aware of and wouldn't know how to access them.
So
that's really the... go ahead.
So they, in that kind of situations, they would come to you and you would redirect them to those, you know, resources, right?
Yes, yes. So I don't actually do any... I do something, but I'm not supposed to provide a service. I'm supposed to refer people to other services. And that's why it's called coordinator, it's resident services coordinator. So it's kind of, does that make sense? Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, it does make sense. Okay. I'm always calling 211. 211 is the Portland City information line, where you could ask them, like, I need emergency dental work. Tell me what's available today, you know, and they can tell you, oh, there's the dentist van, and it's over this part of the city today. And if you turn up at 8 in the morning, you can get in or whatever. So there's and so many people don't even know that they can call 211. So that's like the gap that I'm bridging, is that there is actually a lot of services available, but people don't have the education about it. You know, so I can tell people, you know, I'll hear about stuff. Oh, there's a symptom management seminar going on this month. I can't remember the details about it, but the property manager actually picked up some flyers when he was in a meeting somewhere else and gave them to me, and then I put them on the pin board at work so people could see if they're interested in, it was something for chronic diagnoses, symptom management. And so my role is to help people know about stuff. And as well as that, I also run group activities in the building. And
can I just say, it makes so much sense. It's so huge what you're doing. It makes so much sense to me how that would be such a huge support for people, especially for whatever reason, if you know they're churned up or don't know what to do, and then there's somebody there that they can go to for information and just the kind of emotional support that can provide to knowing there's options.
It's huge.
So I'm just wondering, if they're not aware of the services around, how do they know about you?
Well, I'm actually in the building. So
this is just one particular building?
Yeah.
Are there many buildings where there are people that are likely to be evicted, or how?
Well, my case is a little different from most. Well, ideally there should be, and there isn't really. I've actually had a little contact with other resident services people, but a lot of people, they'll be responsible for three buildings or something, so they're always moving around between them.
And there's a sign on the building door or something, so anyone living in there knows about you there?
With the place that I'm at, everybody knows me anyway, because there's 80 people who live in the building. Well, 81 if there's one couple in the building who live together. Every time somebody moves in, the manager introduces them to me. And even if that doesn't happen, or even after that happens, I somehow get to meet them, or if it's difficult to find them face to face, I put some information under their door. I have like a little welcome package that has useful phone numbers and a map of the area and stuff. And every month I put out a flyer that has like things that are happening in the building on one side, and a calendar of the groups that I run on the back, and that I deliver under people's doors every month. The answer to your question is I don't know what happens in most buildings. And mine is slightly unusual, because I'm kind of, it's a Housing Authority of Portland building, but it's contracted through Cascadia, which is a mental health agency. And I'm the only RSC that Cascadia manages. And it has a history because of the building used to be privately owned, and they contracted through Cascadia, and then the Housing Authority bought the building. And as far as I know, I'm the only RSC that has one 80-unit building. Everybody else is spread more. And I've met one other guy who, there's a building down on 333 Oak, which is, I don't know how big it is, but they have more than 100 people in there, and he is based in that building, and that building alone, but it's also the kind of people who are living in that building. There's a lot more crisis situations. Like he told me the week that he started there, someone was stabbed to death in the corridor in the building. So it's a very, I mean, I work with a population that there are often situations, but there hasn't been anything that extreme in that building, and it doesn't happen as often. So for most buildings, most Housing Authority buildings have an RSC, but they're spread much thinner than I am. So I'm in this really privileged position where I actually have a relationship with everybody who lives in the building, at least the ones that are up and about during the day, because I'm not usually there in the evenings. Sure.
Are you the? I'm gathering from what you're saying that you're the only. What is it?
RSC.
RSC for that building at all. Yeah. So it's they only have access to a support like you when you're there. Then
yeah,
you don't share the position with anyone else.
No.
Okay.
No, and there isn't any. You know, when I take time off, there's no one to fill in. So, and that would normally be the case because it's such. I mean, it's a really. It's social work. I mean, it's not well funded, you know. The Housing Authority of Portland is great, and they have fantastic philosophy, but there's not a huge amount of money to throw around to do this stuff. So, but there is a like an industry support network that is coordinated at Oregon On, which. They're the ones, they have a conference every year, and they're the ones guiding the research, at least in Oregon, and there's countrywide research. They're trying to get, financial figures that they can present to people so that it won't only be people in public housing. Private property managers would, if they had it proved to them that it could save them money, they would then hire agencies. So... resident services coordinator. Yeah. One of the points, one of the philosophies behind it is not to create any kind of dependency. So one of my supervisors said to me one time, and I was asking a question, she said, if you weren't there tomorrow, would that person still be able to get on with what they needed to do? You know? Which is that is there's a line there that's like always going back and forth, especially when there's particular people that really do need more services than they're getting for whatever reason, and it's impossible not to try and fill that gap a little bit. I think that. I can't give like a really accurate picture industry-wide because I do have a different situation, and because my supervision is coming from a mental health agency, so and the mental health agencies are very much there's more of a dependency kind of thing happening there, so I'm kind of bridging in a way. One of the things how long have I been there? I started last April. So it's been almost a year, and one of the cons in me is like I'm trying to work my role really is, you know, whether I'm just whether I'm like there I should keep and not be involved and just be there when people come to me, or if I should be more active. And there's one particular person who lives in the building who doesn't believe he needs any help with anything, but is always asking for help. He's a very difficult person. And I actually took him on the bus to his medical appointment. I called them, I made the appointment for him, and I took him there. I did that once. And then ever since then, I've made all the phone calls for him, and I've reminded him every day when he has an appointment the next day and stuff, which, according to the resident services model, I'm not supposed to do. But if I don't do that, he won't go to the doctor or to the social worker that he sees at the clinic.
That's so the process work seems to come into it.
I was going to say that's where process work seems to enter into it, because you have to be centered enough as a facilitator to sort of say, to call your own shots. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say, in spite of what my job description may or may not be, there's a reality here that, you know, others are requiring some kind of services, and I am the most appropriate person to fill that. And I have to look at myself from a sort of larger perspective and say, mm-hmm. I have to be grounded enough to be able to weather the storms of whether maybe I'll be criticized. Maybe I'll be criticized for trying to get this guy to his appointments on time.
That's certainly true. Yeah. And I also had the huge privilege that my supervisor doesn't see what I do. So, you know, there's two other... I have a great relationship with my immediate supervisor. I don't have any problem with her hearing this, but she's part of this great thing called Cascadia, and we all have to fit in somehow, and she and I are both round pegs in square holes or whatever, however it goes. But, there's me, there's the property manager, and there's the maintenance person, and we're the only employees on site. So I really get to do whatever I want, which is just fabulous for me. And it also means I get to just decide on the spot, you know, is this appropriate for this person rather than is this appropriate for the role? And it works like that. And then, I periodically have to look at myself and think, what, you know, where are my boundaries here? And you know, I have to reassess how I'm relating to people in certain ways. I was going to say something about what I thought I was going to do when I got this job, because it's actually very different. I had some really wonderful high dreams about creating like a process work learning environment and inviting people to explore their own experience and explore their relationships with each other. And I thought I was going to do this by setting up community meetings and different kinds of groups. And I have to say, it didn't get anywhere at all. I remember the first community meeting I had, a lot of people came to. There were 18 people in the room. And I've since realized that they came because they were checking me out. They didn't come because they wanted to be part of a community conversation. They came because I was the new person. They really liked the woman who was in the position before me. They had had temporary people and nobody, like interspersed, for 4 or 5 months. I had a lot of people, I had a lot of negative reception when I first got there, which I understood. And I also know the woman who worked there before me, so it was easier not to take it personally, I think, because I knew her and I like her. It felt like because they'd had temporary people and sometimes nobody there for a while, there were a lot of issues that people had been saving up. So they came to this meeting and they wanted to just complain and air issues. And it didn't happen again. Like, I'd have community meetings after that. I tried to have them every week at first, which didn't work at all. But then there are two or three people who come to every meeting, no matter what it is. And those people would come, but nobody else would. So I gave up trying to do community meetings. I came in feeling like that there would be some kind of structure, or I could create some kind of structure, or that there would be and some kind of community structure in place, and feeling like the management would have some kind of communication structure. There isn't any. And it's actually really, I mean, there is a structure. It's just impossible to name or describe. I've learned, the guy who's the property manager, I have to say this really carefully, he's a really great guy. He's really compassionate and really cares about people. He hates having to do anything like evict people or anything like that. The danger of that is that he doesn't tell people, he doesn't lay down the law adequately enough until people have really crossed the line. So they get a sudden, like, you're being evicted, rather than a series of serious warnings. There's kind of this amorphous communication style in the building that was completely not what I expected when I got in. And this is really, like, any building is going to have its own thing. It's going to be completely different from this. So I kind of fell into this and not able to create any kind of structure that would work for me. And I had to adapt myself to, I notice I'm doing this. There's something like this that happens. And anything that really happens in that building comes through like this gossipy trickle-down kind of thing. And people will come to me to talk to me about stuff they should be talking to Steve, the manager, about. And I will sit and listen and I'll say, I support you. You need to talk to Steve. I'll be with you when you talk to Steve. I can go into the room with you if you want. But I'm not going to talk to Steve for you. And I just, I wonder, like, how there before, how much of those roles mixed up between them.
Don't people face homelessness when they're evicted? I mean, that's the thing with low-income housing. They're really facing a situation where they're going to be in a much less comfortable environment.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Yeah, one of the, I forget that people don't know the environment I work in. There are a lot of people in the building who don't have any money. I think so. There's 80 apartments, 30 of them are one bedrooms, 50 are studios, and all of the studios are subsidized. So the people who live in those studios pay 30% of their income. So if they have no income, the housing authority pays all of their rent. And most of the people who live in the one bedroums have their own, they call it a Section 8 voucher here, where they can live anywhere that would accept that voucher, and the housing authority pays most of their rent, and they only pay 30% of their income. So there are a lot of people in the building who have no income. And for somebody in that kind of situation to be evicted, they don't have any options.
If they have no income, how do they get evicted?
They're not paying rent
anyway.
Yeah, but people get it. So I could get evicted for all sorts of things, but the major thing that people would get evicted for is approved violence in the building. There are cameras up in various places in the building, mostly in the lobby. And the other thing is dealing drugs, which is never provable, but there's a way that property managers, there are all these fine print things in the lease that usually people ignore, but if someone is believed to be, if you know they're dealing drugs, or the manager knows they're dealing drugs, or, you know, it's something equally detrimental to the community, they will get them caught up on those small print things, like having too many visitors or playing their music too loud or something like that.
Violence.
Yeah. Anything illegal happening in the building is a 30-day notice of eviction. And the process goes usually that the person will get that notice and they'll have a right to remedy, which means if they don't ever do that again, I think it's a period of 6 months. If someone gets a notice for playing their music too loud, if they don't do that again for 6 months, they won't be evicted. But if they do it again within that period, they'll have 30 days to get out. So people do, we've had actually not that many people evicted for non-payment of rent, but we've had a few people who've been evicted for various other reasons. And sometimes it's absolutely necessary for the community, because sometimes there are people who really can't live independently or can't live inside or whatever. There are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, they have very bad boundary or very undeveloped boundaries, and people take advantage of them. They've been living on the streets for a long time and they have street buddies. And when they move into an apartment, the street buddies, when people live on the streets, they share everything. Or they have a buddy system where they share stuff. And so when one of those people gets an apartment, it completely disrupts the social network. And if that person doesn't decide to detach themselves from those people and treat them differently, they will get that person evicted eventually, because they'll be coming into their apartment and you can't have people living in your apartment. It's like there's a 5-day limit to have someone stay the night or something. Or they'll be bringing in bed bugs, or they'll be, that kind of thing's happened at least twice, where we've had to evict someone because they can't draw their own boundaries and protect their own housing.
So that's part of your role.
So
teach them boundaries?
Yeah. So if in that kind of situation, it works best if that person is engaged in services somewhere, which they usually are, but that doesn't necessarily mean they go. They might be signed up with someone. And so it would be my position to alert whoever is working with them to come and work with them on that. And but in some cases where that's not possible, I'll do what I can, you know, to but that's another place where the line is undefined, and like, how much do I really get involved? And it's just my judgment call on there, because in some of the cases, well, we have one guy at the moment who's kind of in that situation, and he's actually got a lot of support, because there's an agency called Outside In, which works with young people in Portland, and they have, hey, come in. There's three agencies that have access to 10 apartments each in this building, and so there this young man was referred and has his voucher through Outside In, and he has social workers who come and visit him and check in with him, and he's required to engage with them. And the other agencies are Northwest Pilot Project, which works with seniors, and the other one's Cascadia, which is mental health. So in theory, there's someone for all. Well, there is. The Cascadia one's a bit of a mess at the moment. I hope no one up in Cascadia is going to hear this. But for the other two agencies, if there's a problem with any of their people in the building, I can contact them and they will respond to it right away. For the other people who aren't engaged in services, because it's not housing just for people with disabilities. It's housing for anyone with low income. So there are people who maybe have a disability but have never been diagnosed. And there's also plenty of people in there who don't have any kind of a disability. They just choose to live in that building. But if something happens with one of them, I'm the person who would help them get hooked up with services. And that would look like the ideal situation would be is if they need mental health services, they ask me for help with that, and then I give them the options of where they need to go, and then I follow up with them to ask if they did it and how it's working out. Or whatever. So the more support people have, then the more likely they're going to stay in their housing and not get messed up. I'm not the best judge. Thanks for reminding me. I have some pictures of the building on here. Sure, I'll try.
The question was, where do you run your groups?
That is a great question, and I'm going to show you some pictures here. I've got, I'm a little technologically challenged, so it's just a file full of photographs, and I'm looking for, here it is. Here. The building, that's the conference room, and I get to use it as much as I want, really, unless the housing authority or somebody is coming in for a meeting. I have a lot of fun there. I was told by my Cascadia supervisor to run at least one group a day, because it looks good. You see, their plan is to look good on paper for the housing authority, so that the housing authority will still contract through them. And the housing authority wants to pay Cascadia because it would be cheaper than hiring me immediately, because they have better benefits at the housing authority. Thanks. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put this to the first photograph, and then I'm just going to pass it around. And if anyone wants to ask about the pictures, and people can just, you can just like look, if you want to, you can go backwards and forwards and look at as many as you want. That's the outside of the building there. And if you have any questions about the pictures, just ask. So in there somewhere, there's a picture of my monthly calendar where I have my groups. And I put that out every month. And So on Mondays, I have a craft group in the afternoon, which is really not functioning very well because I don't really know what I'm doing. But I bought a sewing machine the other day. So I'm going to, I don't know, just trying to like make things up as I go along. I had Suzette came in. Another one of the things that's great about being through Cascadia is that there is money available to bring people in and do activities. So Suzette is an artist and art therapist, and what's it called? The Open Studio Project, which you run. And so Suzette came in for 8 weeks, I think it was, once a week, doing some art with the residents. And we still have the art supplies there and on Thursday afternoons. I just get the art supplies out and whoever comes by. There's one person who always comes by. It's like every single group. And then there's another person who comes to almost every group. So, and then sometimes I'll get like 10 people for something, which is just really bizarre. And I'm trying to work out what makes that happen. Tuesday morning, which is the big event of the week, I do breakfast. And this is another huge privilege that I have the money through Cascadia, and I spend about $15 a week. And I make usually pancakes. And because my supervisor isn't telling me what to do and I don't have somebody saying you should budget really well, I buy real orange juice and real fruit. And it's unbelievable what a difference that makes. You know, because people won't buy real orange juice unless it's the first of the month and they've just got their food stamps. And some people might spend all of their food stamps right away on really nice stuff. Or other people will budget really well and never have something really nice because they can't really afford anything really nice. And to me, like, whenever I've been to Cascadia stuff where they provide food for people, it's really crappy food. And that's, I don't know if those staff people eat that way at home or not, or whatever. There's always a mentality of what's the cheapest thing in the store. And although I'm somewhat influenced by that, when I buy snacks, I usually get pastries because they are the cheapest thing. They're also the easiest thing, and everybody likes them. But I still, when I go to buy breakfast stuff, it's, okay, I'm making pancakes, which aren't the healthiest thing, but I'm going to get real orange juice or real grapefruit juice or whatever. Because I make that decision to make it.
Where is the building physically?
It's downtown Portland. It's actually
southwest or northwest?
Southwest. It's on 11th Avenue, just west of the art gallery. It's two blocks away from the art gallery, and it's right by Safeway, which is really bad. Safeway, I don't know, Safeway in San Francisco I remember being really great, but Safeway in Portland is just not a good place. It's very expensive and it doesn't have great quality food. So people basically are limited to spending their money in Safeway because, you know, to go somewhere else is a big deal if you don't have transport. Once a month I borrow this awful clapped out van from Cascadia and I take people to Winco and Walmart out on 82nd. Which is cheaper food. And what else do I do? We have a writers group, which is actually the most thriving non-food related group. we have a very committed core group of writers that turn up, and we just have fun. We do our favorite thing at the moment is to think of 10 unrelated words, and then everybody turns them into a story somehow. And that really kind of stemmed from, we had Right Around Portland came in and did a workshop. Right Around Portland do this amazing job. They run these workshops three times a year. They do like 10 of them at a time. And then at the end of the workshops, they actually produce a book. And they have a reading in this big church hall where everybody has the option to read their work. So we had them come in, and we're going to have them come in again, I think, in the fall. But we've been continuing to meet every week since they left. We had like 10 people involved in the Right Around Portland group, and there's, on a good day, I'll have 5 people in my writing group, sometimes only 2, but there's always people there. And then what else do I do? On Fridays, if I'm not going grocery shopping, which is at the beginning of the month, we watch a movie. And that is actually the time when there's like, obviously there's like different groups of people in the building. There's 80 people and there's like different subgroups of people. When I go to watch a movie, there's the tough alcoholic guys. It's like, they're not all alcoholics, but the tough guys that hang out in the TV room and don't want to do any crafty things. And they watch, I don't know what it's called. It's like the American version of Top Gear. It's like the cars show, right? And they, you know, and then once a week I get an action movie. Every week there's a female resident who runs this movie night called Chick Flick, because the guys kind of run the TV room just through their presence there. So she books the TV room on Tuesday nights and advertises it as Chick Flicks, which discourages the guys from turning up. And so when I said I'm going to do a movie, the guys said, well, don't play any Chick Flicks. So, but I got, what's this movie called? It's an English movie about this girl in the circus. Anyway.
It's kind of a joke of Netflix of woman version, right?
Joke of what? Netflix? Oh, no. Sorry. Oh, sorry. I'm so bad. A chick flick is usually a romantic movie. Or for anyone who's... who's not like if you're a big tough guy that you only want to watch people being shot, anything that has any more depth than that is a chick flick. So anything that makes you think is really not what they want to watch. So
chick is another word for girl, and flick is another word for movie.
Oh, that's girls. Yeah. So thank you. Someone was just explaining what chick flick means better than I did. But one time I wish I could remember what this movie was called. It's an amazing movie. And it's this 14-year-old girl who's trying to run away from the circus, but she gets caught up in this dream world. And it's beautiful. And these guys were on the edges of their seats watching this. And they were like, wow, look at this, such like a dream. They were like so engrossed in it. It was great. So I get to play with them, you know, and like broaden their horizons a little. And then we have a little talk about it afterwards, even though like I don't like this formal like let's discuss the movie. But often we'll just like end up saying a few things about how it made us feel and stuff. Another one of my little process worky things, that's a horrible thing to say in this place. On Thursday mornings, we have a coffee group. Oh, this is Scooby. There's a lot of dogs in the building because a lot of people have companion pets that are prescribed. Yeah, if you have a prescription for a companion pet, the landlord has to allow you to have the animal, which... There are some people who are deathly allergic to animals, so there would be a conflict if that happened, but in this building there isn't. This dog belongs to the oldest woman who lives in the building. She's 72, and she's just amazing. She's having a very, very hard time health-wise at the moment, and so I hardly see her unless I go up to her apartment, but other people walk her dog for her all the time. Mm-hmm. And I just love Scooby. We were trying to get him to stay still, but he wouldn't... Did you meet Scooby?
I think so.
Yeah, he's a little sausage dog, and he's just so cute.
An amazing photograph.
You can see there's a resident's hand and my hand, like trying to hold him still. I'll leave him there. The Thursday morning coffee group was the one day when my supervisor came in and she said, you have to run a group every day. And now I've got six because I've got two on Thursdays. She was like, even if you just do coffee. And so I did that, but I called it the Coffee Dreams group. And and it's like, okay, the conversation topic is dreams. And what's really funny about it is that I've never really tried to get people doing it, but I write dreams on the board. And the property manager sometimes comes to it, and he loves talking about his dreams. He'll come and he'll tell me like this whole epic thing, and he'll draw pictures of it. He dreamt about me, and he drew pictures of his dream with me in it, and I've got them up on my wall. He's so funny. So I don't have to push it. It's amazing. Like every week when we get together, I could be talking about something completely different, and somebody else will start saying, "Well, isn't this the dream group?" And I've always intended, like, people could talk about any kind of dream. It doesn't have to be nighttime dreams. It can be aspirations or, you know, most people, when they think about what are your dreams, it's what do you want, you know. But people always talk about their nighttime dreams. And I don't really get into processing stuff unless somebody is like, oh, I wonder what that would mean. And sometimes I offer, like, could have something to do with what you're working on at the moment, or, you know, what's happening in your life right now, and just kind of little suggestive things. And I don't know where that goes or what happens with it. You know, there's one resident in the building who is really interested in that kind of stuff, and I'm kind of, every now and then I think to myself, maybe I'll lend her a process workbook. Maybe not, you know. There's actually somebody else who knows about process work who lives there, who is, like, really interested. Every now and then we get talking about it, and she asks me questions. So, did you have a question?
I'm curious how
process works. Let's get the microphone. Thanks, Jero.
So how does process work impact this? And just what do you bring from that into this, as opposed mm-hmm. to someone else who would be a resident services coordinator and never right. heard of process work?
It's a really good question. And I wish I could know what it would be like to not be a process worker doing this job. But I don't think I could do it without being a process worker, without having this background and my knowledge of relationships. The major thing that's happening for most of the people that come to me are relationship issues. So when people have a problem with maintenance issues or something in their building, it's because they have a relationship problem with the manager. And so I'm doing a lot of relationship work, and I'm not using any, well, sometimes I do use some very clear interventions, but most of the time I'm not using any really specific interventions, but it's just my general awareness of the relationship stuff, where I can know if somebody comes into my room and is really angry with the manager, I can support that person and support the manager at the same time without saying, obviously, I'm not going to say, I agree with you, he doesn't do his job, because nobody would say that unless they really wanted to get in trouble. But to like really say, yeah, sounds like your issue's not getting addressed, and I really support you to deal with this. I'll go in with you to talk to him. And there's another side to it, you know, that he has a list of priorities, or maybe he doesn't really understand your need at the moment or something. A lot of the time people don't adequately communicate to him, and he doesn't understand what the situation is. We still have an ongoing situation where there's a man who's very disturbed by an intermittent noise that he hears in his apartment, and he told me about it several months ago, or maybe about a month ago, but it had been going on for a long time. And the manager's impression was that it was a very quiet noise, because he'd gone to the apartment and listened, and it had been very quiet. But the resident told me later that the noise gets much louder than that at other times. But he hadn't actually explained that, or whether he explained it or not, the manager hadn't heard that part. So There's a lot of process work coming into that, of like working out where the miscommunication is happening, and really actively supporting both sides at the same time is really important, because a lot of people who find themselves in this kind of situation where they're in, like, they've been on the streets for a long time, and this is like, it's not the kind of building that most people choose to live in. Have relationship problems, You know, there's a lot of people who love to complain about other people, and I happen to know that they're doing the very same things that they're complaining about. But I don't confront them with it. But I like gently trying to support people. There's one guy who has a lot of complaints about his neighbors and them, but I hear from so many people that he's aggressive with them that I know he's being aggressive with them. I'm not, like, isn't it, there's no way everybody is making it up, especially because some of the people who've said it are people that I really believe they're reporting. And so, and he comes to me, and I have a really good relationship with him. He's had a horrific life. He's had, he has a brain injury, and he can't really focus on anything. And he's a very intelligent man. And I've just worked at, it just hasn't been work because I like him, to build a relationship with him to the point where he trusts me and I can say, I don't think you're dealing with these things in a very productive way. I think that you've learned a skill on the streets to show how big and aggressive you are. And he is a big guy and he's intimidating. And I explained to him, when you lived on the streets, that worked because you show people how intimidating you are and they back off. But when you live here, it's not working anymore, is it? And I just like, I don't think it's affected his behavior with other people much yet. But like, I can have these conversations and just support people to get a little bit more awareness of how they're relating to other people.
Yeah. Oh, just to
sure
say that the part that says you're underestimating your ability work with altered and extreme states with people. I mean, just to say, you know, when you said, I don't know how not to be a process worker, that's such a huge part of the training, mm-hmm. and that your ability to do that, you know, you're gifted at that, and that, you know, not to marginalize or minimize it, that is one of the ways you really do work with people and bring process work in, but you're not like naming it as that. So, and maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Thanks, Suzette. I appreciate that. This is why it's so great to have such a nice audience, because I really don't really see that much of what I'm doing from the outside. So, yeah, I'm very comfortable. I'm comfortable with people in different states of consciousness. And that's partly through my process works training and partly because I worked for I don't know how many years in mental health, and I worked in transitional housing before when there were a lot of people who were in extreme states constantly. And so it's kind of second nature to me to not be too thrown off when people are doing something that's off the wall or being, you know, one time in this building, I had someone just scream at me out of the blue, and it was because I got my hair cut. She couldn't stand my haircut, and she called me all sorts of names because of it. And I'm not saying it didn't upset me, but I think I dealt with that in a way that's like, I'm used to that kind of thing happening, or I can understand it more immediately. I actually have a really good relationship with her now. She didn't talk to me for several weeks, and then, you know, I didn't take it personally, I think is part of it, and she just, she decided she liked me again. There are some, thank you for that. Actually, one of my notes down here says city shadows, because that's a huge part of the community, because there are so many people there who really are real city shadows, that they're really suffering. They're really, I wouldn't fit in somewhere else. And this is one of the things I just... Thank you. So, City Shadow is in one of Arnie's earlier works on the on extreme states. He just defined a city shadow as somebody who is kind of carrying an extreme state for the community. Like, often I think of a city shadow, like a classic city shadow, is a kind of person that is doing something wild and weird on the street, and they're unkempt and the kind of person that other people label as crazy is a city shadow. They're often people that are very difficult to communicate with and very difficult to work with. As a process for the city or the world, they're the most marginalized part that that is not being invited into regular culture. And that's one of my, it's one of the most challenging things, but it's one of my favorite things about the environment that I work in, because it really shows how much community people are capable of at this financial level. I mean, people are so, it's a completely different culture from middle-class culture, where to stereotype people, people often just look away or expect somebody else to deal with it, or they want that to go away or whatever. That people are so much, even though they have so many relationship problems and they have actual physical fights more often than other people would because they're not so good at communicating, there's an understanding of people who are in trouble. And there's one particular guy, I can't avoid talking about this guy, who is absolutely impossible to deal with over the long term. And he's not engaged in any services because he doesn't believe he needs any. He's physically disabled as a result of driving his motorbike into a brick wall about 15 or 16 years ago. And his story is that he was in a coma for 6 years and he woke up in the back of a coroner's wagon. And so he's supposed to be dead, which I believe. I mean, he really had a serious physical trauma. And I don't know what his situation was before that or what he was like before that. But he's in constant pain and he complains all the time that nobody's helping him. And he won't accept any help. He's the guy that I took to the medical clinic that one time. And he's really extremely irritating. And he can't budget his money. He either gives it all away or spends it all right away. But people in the building feed him. And there are a lot of people who avoid him completely. He gets angry instantly. He flies off the handle, and it can be quite scary because he says that he will hit people, but he never does. But there are a lot of people who will avoid him, but there are so many other people who actively make relationship with him, even though he's completely narcissistic and won't listen to what you're saying, and turns everything around so it's about him and his problems, there are still people in that building who consistently reach out to him and give him food and support him and give him cigarettes and make sure he's okay. And that's...
Are you comfortable with that?
Nicole just asked if I'm comfortable with that. Can you tell me more...
I don't know why I'm asking this. Are you comfortable with that?
With what? What about it?
With the care that he receives from others?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think it's fabulous because, in a system where people should have, if you can't manage your own money, you should have somebody else manage it for you. Or if you can't go to the doctor by yourself, you have to have a case manager who will. Whatever, he wouldn't survive unless there were people around willing to help him, because he doesn't, he hates all people who are assigned to him to work with him. He likes me mainly because there's another place where the process work comes in, is that I've built a really good relationship with him to the point where I can tell him to shut up and stop complaining, and nobody else can do that. I've done it like two or three times over the last 9 months because I've just got to my limit and said, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. You're going to stop complaining and start thinking about somebody else. And he doesn't change, but he stops for a couple of hours. You know, and that to me is like pretty amazing. And I don't do that every day. I can't, because I have too much sympathy for him. But I love that the other people support him. And I think that's a community that I really want to be part of, where people will help even the people that are the most irritating.
What is it you think that you've done with him through relationship that's helped you get to that place with him?
A lot of it, I think most of it is from my process work training. And part of it is my naivete when I first came into the building. I came straight from only doing process work, but I had quit my previous job about 6 months before that. So I was totally focused on process work and my individual clients. Straight from that and being a lot by myself and working on myself a lot to being in this reality where people don't work on themselves and people are very underprivileged. And I was in a different frame of mind from my reality now. I was very much more centered in my process. And so I was treating everybody I met as like, you know, we're in this dream world together and we're like in our process together. And he says these amazing things. And now I just kind of go, oh, yeah, it's that again. But back then it was like, wow, really? Did that happen to you? And I took everything he said at completely face value. And a lot of it is like amazing. He talks about when he was dead and when he went to heaven and when God told him to come back and how angry he is about that. And the story changes a lot. And there's a lot of, like, sometimes he's angry and sometimes he's grateful and whatever. But I really found that amazing. And it was genuine. And I was, like, just really absorbing it and listening to him and supporting him there. And I think, you know, knowing a lot of the people around, a lot of people wouldn't want to listen to that. You know, even the more realistic parts of it where he talks about his trauma, people wouldn't want to listen to it. And I did, and I think that's... And I continue to take him seriously. Like, even when I need him to stop, I'm not going to patronize him or just close the door or whatever. I communicate it to him, even if he can't really take it in. I say, I can't take it anymore. Or, I need to do my work. Like he's kind of gotten this thing where he will come and he'll want to talk to me all the time. And more recently he's been, oh, I know I keep talking to you too much, but can I come in and get candy? I don't know if anyone saw the pictures there. I have a bowl of candy. I mean, it's terrible. It's like the worst thing. But people donate candy all the time. So I just put it out in a bowl. And he's addicted to sugar, so he comes in. I have dog treats too, so... It kind of evens out. I do not give candy to the dogs, and I only give the dogs treats if the owners say it's okay. Yeah. You know, I know everyone's really tired because you're in the intensive, so if anyone just needs to leave, that's like totally cool. But what time is it?
I was just going to ask.
It's 10 after 8.
Okay. How do you stop yourself from doing process work?
That's a really good question. I really... I had a pretty dramatic learning curve going through, like starting there. I've begun to kind of level out in the last few months. When I first got there, I treated everyone as a client, I think I was aware enough that I shouldn't be doing that I didn't really go deep with people. But people would come to my office and want to sit there and talk to me. And I would, like, all day, every day, I'd have people coming through my office and sitting and talking to me. And I was encouraging it, and really as if I was talking to a counseling client. And I think that's great that I did that, because it really helped me build relationships with people. But it was a dynamic that doesn't work, and it isn't. And I hadn't had enough guidance in what my role was at the time to see that it wasn't what my role was. You know, I was struck really, at one point I was really trying to get some like communication skills groups going or something. I can't remember what I called it. I think it was communication skills or conflict resolution or something. I started this group, and I was really trying to do some real process work, intervention, relationship work with people, and it backfired on me. And what happened was, I had two people come to this group. One is the guy that I was talking about just now, and one was the woman who actually knows about process work. I think she's read some books. I don't even remember what we started with. I didn't even know that they had a conflict, but we started with something. And oh, I know what it was. He's always talking about these violent things that he's done and had done to him. And she can't deal with it. She deals with it. She walks away, but she doesn't want him to do it. And so we did this process around trauma, and I did kind of a classic process work thing. I was like, I got my backpack, and I was like, okay, this is the trauma, and it's on the chair. And she was like, "That I don't want to be near that." And so I put it, and I hid it behind the plant or whatever, and she was like, okay, I can handle the trauma not being here. And then they started having this relationship conversation where she explained to him that because of her PTSD, she couldn't hear the violence that he often talked about. And he listened to her, and he understood what she was saying, and he said, yeah, I can understand why you walk away from me now. And then after that, they both got completely different impressions about what happened. And to me, because I was still in this environment of, I've been working with process workers mostly, and most of my clients in my private practice are more self-aware than this guy is. And I don't know, maybe if I'd done another step, if it would, you know, if I'd helped them really bring out what they got from it, then it would have worked. But she stopped talking to him after that. For her, she learned that she couldn't have a relationship with him. She didn't want to talk to him anymore. But he thought that she was accepting his, he didn't actually apologize. Well, maybe he did apologize. But he thought that she was making relationship with him. And so it actually, in the long term, I think it's good. But in the short term, he was very upset when she wouldn't talk to him anymore. And I have to say, that was about 6 months ago, and they have interacted since then. It's not like it was like set in stone or whatever. And both of them learned something. She probably learned more than him because I don't think he has the capability for things to really stick. That was the moment, that was actually when I called you or emailed you and said I want to give a presentation because I felt so good about like really directly using process work skills, and it really was a familiar, like it really felt like it does in this room when I work with people in here. And I was really excited about that, but then nobody came to those groups anymore. And I think I went too deep. And so when you ask me what stops me doing process work is that I can't go too deep with these people because it's not my role. You know, and I'll be with you in just a second. Because it's my job, I'm part of the community and I have a specific role there, I can't be the one to go that deep with them. And which saddens me in a way because that's what I want to be doing. Thanks for coming. But it's too much, it's too dangerous to disrupt the community that way. This gentleman had a question. Oh, thanks. Hi.
I ask myself, if you have such a situation where you can't work in the way you might want to, because you use your own experience and your own way of dealing and how you studied and try to bring this in such a situation where that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
What you said, it's too deep and it's not really current how they're deal with each other. And but because now you describe that use a structure that works. So to do these groups and to be a part of the community. How is your own dreaming about? So how your inner work? So how is your own perception about being together with these people? And how do you experience the process? I mean, because there's always a process.
Yeah.
If you use these techniques or drink a coffee together, that. Yeah.
That's a great question. A lot of the time, I'm completely lost because every now and then I have these wake up moments where I realize, oh, the dynamics have shifted. Whether it's between me and the rest of the rest of the people who live there, or if it's between me and the manager, or everything. And I don't notice the trees because I'm in the forest most of the time. And every now and then I'll have like a wake up. And, you know, it's interesting that I don't specifically work on myself about any of my issues at work. I think it's part of my own like inner boundary where I keep work at work. There's something in me that refuses to let it impinge on my time outside of work, and that makes me think, well, maybe I do it. I think it would be interesting to actually make time while I'm there to work on myself on the stuff there, because I think it would have more powerful impact on the field, actually. And I think I'm getting to a place where I'm probably going to start doing that. But I think most of the time that I've been there, I've been kind of lost in not being able to see what's going on. And that's kind of a normal thing for me, for the thing that I'm in every day, that I don't see it. And it's quite difficult to kind of extricate myself and get the detachment I need to really understand it in process work terms or any kind of detached terms. But that would be where I'm going, I think, with it. So that's a good question.
It makes total sense to me that doing that kind of relationship work when there's so much deep trauma in the field would be too like arousing if there's not the kind of follow-up support mm-hmm. there. I mean, just because, I mean, I think we've probably all experienced that one little work in the center, right? Mm-hmm. Can be so deep, but it's not necessarily complete. It may be momentarily complete, right. But it might also be like hatching something, you right. know? And
right. and then all those people can go to a private therapy session.
Right.
For their friends.
Their own work.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it sounds very respectful in a way of the context to not be trying to push that. But then I was also thinking, I mean, from what you've said, that there's so much relationship work that mm-hmm. you're doing mm-hmm. implicitly through your work. And then I'm yeah. thinking about like trauma, right? Is all about like relationship work, basically. And misuse of power. And mm-hmm. and it seems like in a way, you could be working on that quite a lot just by what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like by working on the current dynamics in the field and the housing manager and people feeling like they're not being treated well or mm-hmm. what's being triggered, you know, amongst the people who live there and really bringing in both sides and, you know, empowering them and all of those things. It's like you probably are working so much with what is in the field and in the backgrounds and mm-hmm. but in a way in a more potentially manageable emotionally manageable and useful way mm-hmm. for them. Those, mm-hmm. that's just how I'm digesting what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's my experience mm-hmm. too. Like I'm not even aware at the levels that me being there and the awareness that I have affects. I mean, without like, there's a part of me is like, whoa, getting a really fat head here. But I think it really does just in the conversations, the way that I speak and bringing my awarenesses in without even being aware of it, you know, and not realizing how much impact it has. You know, and the other, you know, we mentioned trauma. Of course, the big thing all the time is conflict, and people are always having conflicts, and it's very rare that I actually get to a situation where I'm mediating between two people because they do not want to talk to each other. I've had maybe five over the last 9 months where I've actually had the two people in the room together. And some of those times have been like amazingly successful. And people have actually been able to communicate better with each other afterwards. But most of the conflict, there's either between each other, neighbors bothering each other, or with the management. And that one, you know, it's much easier to just be in the room when they're talking to the manager. But I don't see myself as a facilitator in that. I see myself as a support and an observer. So I very rarely get involved in the conversation. But just addressing, sorry, that's my cell phone. Just addressing the conflict and naming it and helping people see their part in it. And, you know, and sometimes even having, okay, it's, you know, suggesting to somebody that they're reacting as if it's a different situation, you know, that they're used to reacting in a certain way to something, or, you know, without naming it, like you experienced something in your past that's making you react, you know, without being psychological about it too much, just letting people get these little things. And in general, I get a lot of positive feedback. I don't know what the manager really thinks of me. I mean, we have a good relationship. It was really bad at first. He communicates in a completely different way from me. We had a hard time at first. But I managed to connect through him by talking about stuff that isn't work-related. And somehow we manage now. He used to drive me nuts. But and I just recently realized that maybe I'm going too far the other way, that I don't get irritated enough by him, actually. But it's a huge thing, looking at the conflict. And like the one guy that I said to him, you look at yourself, you know, how aggressive are you being with this? So there's a lot of process work there, and like just finding the very gentle way to bring to people the question of, you know, what is my part in it? Because people are so accusatory, and they do not look at themselves, and that's not true. There are plenty of people who will say, I know I'm culpable too, but there are a lot of people who don't look at themselves when there's a conflict. So
I just wanted to say, from Johannes's comment about how you feel, and then you said you still don't know what you're doing, and well, that's in the field though. I mean, what do those people in that building know what they're doing?
Yeah.
You know, it's just this lost feeling. So that's good that you're feeling like that, I think, because that's supporting them as well.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
I wonder if this way to be unaware, mm-hmm. and to be more together in a field and shifting more indirectly, like with the juice you bring to the breakfast. So mm-hmm. you do things spontaneously, uh-huh. out of your own feeling without reflecting, but it's also a moving together in a field.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting way to look at process work on a different level.
Right. You're reminding me of something that I forgot to mention. I don't know how many of you saw the pictures of my office on here. When I got into the building, the office was laid out with the desk in the middle, so that the RSC would be sitting behind the desk. There's the desk and there's the door, and then the resident would sit at a chair on the other side of the table. There was some shelves with some cans of food on by the door, and one of the first things the manager said to me when I came in was, oh, you probably want to move that because those could be used as weapons. And and it's funny, I did actually move the stuff out of the office into the closet for a while because I didn't want them there, not because they were being used as weapons, but they'd come back again anyway. The first week that I was there, I moved all the furniture around. So you saw the pictures where it's all open, and my chair is directly facing. You know, I can just turn around from the computer and directly face people, and I put that the batik up on the wall because it was just blank white walls. There were a couple of posters up, but they were all really. I don't know what the people had before because they probably took their personal stuff with them, but. You know, just putting that colored batik on the wall. It was really nice colors, and it cost me $15, you know. And that's using process work on a consensus reality level. It just completely changes the dynamic of a conversation when someone comes into the room. And I'm not sitting there expecting someone to be confrontational with me. And I've never had an issue with anyone except for the one woman who shouted at me about my haircut. And she was way on the other side of the lobby anyway, you know. And there are people, I'm not very big, you know, and there are some people in that building who are much bigger than me who could really hurt me. I'm not a good fighter. But I never feel that I need any kind of escape route or anything. And it's funny because the manager picks up the other side of that. He has his own issues, and he has PTSD. He used to be in the military. And he won't sit down if the other person doesn't sit down. And he has his, you know, he's behind his desk. And he gets intimidated quite, well, he doesn't get intimidated. He feels threatened if people get too close to him. So it's interesting that that's happening. But he also, I've had a couple of people come to me and say that he's doing the same thing to them. So he just has a different awareness around body proximity and stuff. But yeah, that's actually like when asking like how do I use process work, it's actually the smallest things. Like it seems small, moving the furniture. I mean, it was heavy. it wasn't the easiest thing, but it is the easiest thing to move the furniture, and it is a huge relationship work right there. So
yes, how did you deal with the lady who shouted at you about the haircut?
I was saved from that one. The manager heard, and he came out of his office and interrupted and told me to go in my office. And I was happy to do that. I was happy for him to deal with it. And and you know what? She didn't want me to ever communicate with her. So I didn't. I just completely respected that, and I didn't have anything to do with her. And then one day she came to me. She came to breakfast a couple of times, and then one day after breakfast she apologized to me. And actually, on a personal process level, this woman has very strange boundaries. She has a very severe abuse history, and she doesn't recognize other people's, like I've had the boundary conversation with her. She's too touchy for me, and I've told her, like, that's within my personal boundaries, please don't touch me. But then when she apologized, she hugged me, and I let that happen, you know, because for me that was an appropriate moment. So I really feel like it was like some learning thing for her in her own boundary making. Something that I did crossed her boundary. It crossed her psychological boundary. She didn't like my haircut because it was too short, and she thought because I had a short haircut, I was a heathen lesbian. She used like really, really foul language to put that point across. But in the moment, I dealt with it really badly because she said, and you need to go to church. And that really pissed me off. And I was about to say something about respecting all belief systems, but then that's when the manager came out. And it was a good thing, because otherwise it would have escalated really badly. But I just don't, you know, every now and then I push her a little bit around belief systems very, very gently. Because there are a lot of Christian people in the building, but there's also a lot of people of different belief systems. And so I just kind of put it in there every now and then. And, you know, somebody's talking about sexual orientation, I just kind of throw some comment out. And she doesn't react to it. So, you know, it is not that maybe her belief isn't as rigid as it came across, you know. I'm sorry, did I answer your question? I don't even remember what it was. Sorry. Yeah. What do you think? It's 8:30. And anyone got any more questions? We got plenty of time.
What I realized, we had in the morning a class about extreme moments,
mm-hmm.
like really escalating conflicts in all kind of contexts, like mm-hmm. in big groups, but also in like family or other contexts. Mm-hmm. And what I realized very much is that to burn your own wood,
mm-hmm.
like that you really did your own homework and really work deep in yourself, change a lot in the relationship. So that really makes room to deal with a lot of situations.
Yeah.
So what you see it about the manager and what's get triggered with the group and that he really takes another role in the whole concept.
Yeah,
and then maybe
yeah.
it's good that there's somebody who takes this role.
Right.
But that you go easy with the whole situation and then only the way how you react in a normal way
mm-hmm.
that is inside yourself really opens so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that really support this point of view.
That's a huge thing, yeah. I can put a plug in for the process work program there. All the hard work I did going through the program. burning wood and yeah. So become a diplomate. It's a good idea.
You're plugging the programs. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I don't know why I'm being so shy about it.
Maybe you want to say something else.
I think I said earlier I wouldn't be able to do this job if I wasn't a process worker. And for me, going through the program, I don't know what I would be like if I hadn't, but I believe I've learned a huge amount more than I would have done if I didn't have that structure. There's, you know, this job and everything else I'm doing in my life, I just don't see how it would be if I didn't have my process work background, you know. And partly because I appreciate everything with a different understanding. I have more awareness of everything that I do. So I think I appreciate the people more where I work and the dynamics of the building. And there's a lot, you know, when I don't feel like going to work, which is a lot of the time actually, I can access where I do want to be there so much easier than I would if I was just coming from a place of like, this isn't my choice or whatever, you know. So, yeah.
More questions or? Yeah.
I've been taking up a lot of space.
It's good.
I was just going to say, you're doing something with those people and they will really miss you, because I feel like I even know some of the characters in that building just from what you've been saying. So they're a big part of you, and I think what a loss, you know, if you do find something else, because yeah. Well, anyone can do that job, but not the way that you're doing that job.
Right. Thank you. Thanks. I don't plan on leaving anytime soon, but you know. Who knows what will happen. But thank you, everybody, for coming. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you. Thanks for all the good questions and the opportunity. I've certainly thought deeper about what I do, and I learned some things from your questions. So.
Maybe one last thing. What I realized, I mean, we are here in the winter intensive, but what I see is that there is like this circles of people who are intense, busy with the process work. Mm-hmm. And then for sure there are people who have all kind of work fields where they're practice as therapists or mm-hmm. in other fields. But what I really admire is if there is spaces where this work really come into bigger circles,
mm-hmm.
so that it really, if it's world work or other stuff, that it really touches a group that is normally not involved
mm-hmm.
in groups of activists, of groups of people who do therapy or whatever. So it's really, yeah, important work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. It's really good to be reminded of that. Thanks very much.
So, thank you so much for coming, Alva, and sharing all of your experience.
Thanks. And thank you, Katya, for organizing it.
It's a pleasure.
Katya organizes all the research symposium. So.
Yeah, thanks to everybody for coming. I don't know if anyone will be back in town in May and June, but that's when we have two cohorts graduating, one from the Master's in Conflict Facilitation and then the other from the Master's in Process Work, and they'll be presenting their final... It just dawned on me. I was like, Jiro is one of those who I am speaking of. So they'll be presenting their final project research. So that's about 30 different topics of how process work is being explored. So it's a really going to be an exciting time if you're in town. And I do believe they will be recorded and available for download as well. So thank you, everybody.